You're listening to another great Torah class, recorded by TorahAnytime.com.
In the Jewish world, an author of notes. He was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, and he studied medicine and graduated with distinction in surgery. Spent a year in St. Louis as an American Field Service Scholar, and subsequently returned there for elective work in internal medicine at Washington U. He's also a founder and director of the Jerusalem Medical Ethics Forum, which the purpose of this organization is to teach and promote knowledge of Jewish medical ethics internationally. He's also written many highly acclaimed books, actually a brand new book titled Will, Freedom, and Destiny that's not really out yet. It was supposed to be here tonight, but unfortunately it wasn't shipped on time. But stay tuned for that. And he currently lives in London and teaches at the Osmeh, the Jewish Learning Exchange, on lectures on Jewish thought and medical ethics and many other deep and very deep and interesting and Jewish topics. So without further ado, it's a big honor, a big pleasure to introduce Rabbi Dr. Amir Ganesh.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to study together. At the very least, you'll learn how to speak English correctly. The subject we're discussing tonight is the question of reaching out, communicating, speaking to people of our generation, those who were brought up in the religious world, those who were brought up normal. How do you communicate? What are the ideas, what are the modes of communication that we found to be successful? One of the questions that often comes up is what makes us different, unique, better? Sometimes in a Kiruv type discussion, one of the approaches or the questions one is asked is, I believe in God, but why is the Jewish approach better? What makes us unique? Why are we special? God, understand, the world has to have an origin. But why are we unique? They're competing theories, competing religions. This question comes up in many guises. And I thought perhaps we could take a line on this evening in a way that I hope you'll find useful and put our finger on something fundamental. You know, the Rambam says, and experience shows, of course, that it always pays to focus on fundamentals. If you can put your finger on something basic, on a principle, many other things fall into place correctly. So let's try to study a subject together this evening that I think will lead us to a fundamental, and I hope you'll find it useful in many ways. And I don't think it gets much more fundamental than this. What is it that we brought to the world? Right? What is really our unique contribution? If you ask an educated Western thinker, Jewish, non-Jewish, you ask him what was unique about Abraham, Avraham Avinu, what did he bring to the world? I think 99% of people you asked would give you one word as an answer. And that word would be?
Monotheism.
And I don't think that's right. I don't think it's correct. The conception out there is that what it brought to the world was an idea of one God. It was an atheistic and pagan world. And he taught the world that there's one God and he proved it, or as Rabbi Gottlieb would say, he gave them adequate evidence. And that was his contribution. And I'd like to show you why I think that's wrong, and then see if we can reach a little bit deeper and understand something, I think, in one way more sophisticated than what is usually said about this subject. First of all, it's obvious, with a little thought, that he did not bring the idea of Hashem to the world, of one God to the world. First of all, he lived in a generation when people were teaching the Torah of one Shem already. Right? Shem and Aver. Shem was Noah's son. He and a man called Aver had a yeshiva. They were teaching authentic Torah. They were on the scene long before Avraham Avinu was born, right? Shem was a survivor of the flood, and Avraham Avinu was born afterwards. So if they were already teaching an authentic Torah in the world, right, the Torah of Hashem, How do we say that he was the one who originated that idea? We know that the Torah they're teaching was authentic. How do we know that? What proofs or evidence would you bring? First of all, why are they doing the answering? Why are you looking to them? You don't have nothing to say? You agree, huh? Yeah. Are you married? You're ready. You're ready.
No, brains work different.
First of all, Yaakov Avinu went to study in the yeshiva of Shem and Eva for 14 years. Right? It was good enough for him to study there. So there's no question it was an authentic yeshiva. And by the way, a side question we can ask is, why did he need to study there? What had he not learned in his father and grandfather's house that made it necessary to study for 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem and Eva? What was unique about their Torah that he hoped to gain? Can you think of another proof that yeshiva was very great and authentic, that its leaders were incredibly great people? This time you answer, but a woman's question. That's right. Rivka went to ask when she was carrying a pregnancy that was difficult. She felt some sort of sense of torment in her pregnancy. She went to ask Avraham, right? Shem wasn't alive anymore. She went to ask. And he told her, you have twins in your womb. There'll be two great nations. And that explained the tension. Obviously, they were great enough to ask questions requiring prophecy. And by the way, there's another side question here. I'm not sure we'll have time to answer all these questions. But a fascinating side question is, why did she have to ask Shem that question? Why didn't she ask her father-in-law? Her father-in-law, Avraham Avinu, right, was the greatest, Yitzhak was the greatest. She had access to the greatest people on earth. Avraham, Yitzhak. Why did she have to ask Shem that question? But however you cut it, you see, that was authentic Torah being taught long before Avraham Avinu came on the scene. Secondly, he met Noach. Noah was alive, right? In fact, it's quite easy to remember. Avraham Avinu was 58, that's Gematria of Noach, when Noah died. So there was already a person who had met Hashem and spoken to him personally, right? Who'd survived the flood and brought that message to the world very clearly. Look at it another way. And in this particular edition of the Chumash, they have a chart that you can actually see it graphically. Do you know that if you put your head back into the genealogy of those original generations, you know that Avraham Avinu met someone who met someone who met someone who met Adam. Look at the timelines, right? You're talking about somebody who knew someone and knew someone who knew Adam or Rishon. Which means that they were so close to the beginning of history, it's ridiculous to suggest that the idea of God had been forgotten. You're talking about the beginning of mankind, people walking the earth who had seen someone, had seen someone, had seen that. There was a tremendous yeshiva teaching Torah. And therefore, it's very hard to build a thesis that they did not know about one God. It's true they were idolatrous, not atheistic, idolatrous, and that needs a separate discussion. Idolatry does not mean not knowing about God. Idolatry means that you accept intermediaries as having some sense of power. Right? And idolater is not somebody who denies God. The Rambam says that the early idolaters used to speak about Hashem. They called him Elokah de Elohim. They called him the God of all the gods. And they weren't interested in him. They were interested in the departmental heads. The powers that deliver the goods, right? The God of rain, the God of war, the God of peace, the God of fertility. They were dealing with intermediaries, what we call the mazalot. Mazal means to flow down. They were interested in setting up intermediaries in the channels that bring down the energy from Hashem to us. There's an element of truth in that. There's an element that is false. But they were not atheists. And therefore, the world richly knew about God. Even the Greeks, who introduced atheism, talked about the fact that Hashem, that there was a God who created the world, who's now engaged in other things, what they call the watchmaker theory. So point one in this discussion is that if you try to suggest that Avraham Avinu, Abraham, brought to the world the idea of one God, that really cannot be correct. And so the question we have to ask is, what did he really contribute? Right? What did he really bring to the world? The common answer to this question, and I think it's inadequate, the common answer to this question is that he brought Kiruv to the world. That means Shem and Eva were learning Torah, they were on their mountaintop retreat, and they were very dynamic and intense in their studies, but they didn't go out and reach out to a world. And Avraham Avinu went out, he argued with people, he used their own logic to prove that they were wrong. He brought them in, he converted people. I'm sure that answer is correct, but I don't think it's enough. I think there's something deeper here. So let me suggest to you a pathway through this question that I hope you'll find very powerful in terms of its ability to explain many aspects of Torah. What he brought to the world, I'll say it as briefly as possible and then try to think it through. He didn't bring Torah to the world. Shem and Eva were teaching Torah. But he brought the concept of mitzvah to the world. Let me try to explain this. The knowledge of a spiritual reality, the knowledge that God exists, and that he had given a Torah, or they would give a Torah, the Torah knowledge was apparent to them already. That was not new. But what he brought to the world was a combination of the spiritual and the physical. He lived in a world that had split the two, where spiritual teaching was something tremendously elevated, but bringing it down into the practical, making a unity between those two, was something that the world was opposed to. You know that, and this was a potent message, by the way, you know they tried to kill him because of this. Nimrod threw him into a fire. By the way, another side question here is why did Nimrod and his people never try to kill Shem and Eber? You know that they had a philosophy, that generation that built the tower, they had their idolatrous philosophy. And when Avraham Avinu stood and opposed them on one side, they tried to kill him. Right? They threw him into a fire. Why did they not try to kill Shem and Eber? They were teaching the same message. Right? Also a fundamental question. But I think the answer is this. He brought to the world a unification of spirit and body. He came upon a world in which there was knowledge of the spiritual, but the knowledge of the spiritual was elevated and the physical was a separate realm. Let's explore this. The history of this idea is that when the human was created originally, Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve were created originally, there was a perfect harmony between body and soul. The two domains that we call Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Ra, or call it Neshama and Guf, spiritual and material, they were in such perfect harmony that the one revealed the other. You know how we say, the Torah puts this? The Torah says that the soul lived in a body that was naked. The body needed no garments because the body, the external, demonstrated the internal. What does it mean that they were naked? You know, the nakedness of man and woman originally defined their condition. You see this very clearly. After the chet, after the sin, Hashem arrives in the garden and he says to Adam, is hiding, where are you? And he schleps himself out from under the trees. And Hashem says to him, did you eat the fruit of the tree? Where have you been? So he says, I was naked and ashamed. I was naked and ashamed. That's the problem. The problem is you disobeyed me. You ate the fruit when I commanded you not to. That's not the way Adam grasps the problem. The way they grasped the issue was nakedness and shame. So you see, this is fundamental. What does it mean to be naked and unashamed? So Rav Dessler speaks about this in detail. You see the Chazal talk about it in many different ways. The condition of the human being originally was that the soul and the body were in such intense harmony that clothes were necessary. The reason clothes were not necessary is because the body showed the neshama. You know, the way you could put it is that the body was transparent. Put it like this. The Gemara in one place says that they wore originally kosmos or they wore garments of light. Garments of light. What does it mean to wear a garment of light? Light is the medium of revelation. It means when you looked at the body, you saw the neshama. You know that the way they looked then, the way Adam looked then, was the opposite of the way we look now. If you look at a human being now, you see only the body. You only see the body. If you look very carefully, you can see a faint glow of a neshama on the face. And I unfortunately have had to spend time watching people die. A few seconds before death and a few seconds after death, something leaves the face. Very hard to put your finger on, but it's palpable. But it's very faint. All you see is the body, and there's a very faint glow that we call the ziv panim, something on the face. But Adam Rishon was exactly the opposite. When you looked at him, you only saw the neshama. And if you looked very carefully, you could make out the outlines of a body. Like looking at a 1,000-watt electric bulb, you see only the light. You look carefully, you can see the glass. Rav Dessler puts this very dramatically. He says that, you know, now you see a human being, you see only the body. You look very carefully, maybe you'll see a vestige of the soul. When Adam Rishon was formed originally, you looked at him, you saw only the soul. And it took a lot of effort to see the body. Because the body was subservient, it was there only to demonstrate the neshama. You see this in so many ways. One of the very humiliating ways you see this is this. And this is a classic explanation of Rav Dessler's also. Do you know that the way we think about ourselves, the way Adam thought about himself, Adam and Chava thought about themselves was only spirit. Their entire consciousness was an intense desire to be close to Hashem. The earthy, sensual, lecherous material spoke at a distance in the second person. That means when Adam said I, when Adam Rishon said I, he was only referring to his neshama. I was just an intense desire to be close to Hashem. The material, the animal, the sensual, was a serpent speaking from a distance. Would you like to sin? In the second person. After the sin, our condition now is, when we say I, you mean only the body, only the sensual. It's embarrassing, but it's true. And it's very easy to demonstrate. Imagine you're facing something delicious, especially when you shouldn't be eating it. Which voice speaks, first or second? Always first. I'd like to taste that. I'd like to taste that. And the conscience? No, you shouldn't. Very embarrassing. But that's the way it is. When we say I, you know, the Gemara put this even more shockingly. The Gemara says that the Yetzer Hara has seven names. Right? The Yetzer, that means the sensual drive, has seven names. And one of them is the Tzfoni. It's called the Tzfoni, that means the hidden one. So Gemara says because the Yetzer, the sensual drive, this childish pull towards the material, is hidden deep within the human consciousness. When I saw that Gemara for the first time, I thought, really? My Yetzer is hidden? I know exactly where it is. Me, my Yetzer, it speaks to me all the time. First thing I hear when I open my eyes in the morning, right? He says, you know how tired you are. You know how cold it is out there. He speaks to me loud and clear. How can Chazal tell us that the Yetzer is hidden within you? And the answer is depressing. The answer is that the one doing the analysis is him. Right? When you say, you know, Rav Moshe Shapiro put it like this. He said, what's the right way to rob a bank? I mean, you have to imagine him saying this, but what's the right way to rob a bank? You walk in with a motorcycle helmet and a gun. No, that's not for a Jewish boy. The right way to rob a bank is you make an appointment with a manager, you walk into his office, you put a sock in his mouth, you tie him up, you lock him in the closet, you sit at his desk, you run the bank. Right? That's the sensible way to rob a bank. That's what's been done to you by the Yetzer. When you say, I think I'll do this, I think I'll learn a bit more, I think I'll learn a bit less, it's him speaking. It's him doing the speaking. The real you is locked up in the closet someplace going, maybe, ne'ila, you know, location, maybe. And therefore there's been an inversion. The original consciousness was neshama only, and the body was only a vessel for that. And that kind of a body doesn't need clothing. Because that body demonstrates the neshama. After this sin, there's been a tremendous mortal battle set up between the two. The solution, of course, is clothing. It's not time now to go into it in detail. But garments, know what the Gemara says, before they were garments of light, and now we wear garments of or. Before it was cosmos or, right? Ayin Aleph Vav Resh. Now it's Ayin Vav Resh. Hashem sewed them garments of light. When man sinned originally, he took fig leaves to cover his nakedness. And Hashem said, I'm going to teach you a fundamental lesson for all of history. Try to make the problem the solution. You now trying to cover your nakedness, use garments to cover your nakedness, because you've lost your dignity. Use clothes now to reveal your dignity. Clothing has two functions. Clothes cover your nakedness and they reveal your dignity. When a king wears a royal robe, it covers the nakedness of the king and it shows you that he's royal. Right? So that our garments now are there to hide the nakedness and to reveal the dignity. The word beged in Hebrew means treachery. Beged means treachery. Right? Because now, in the old English word for a traitor was a turncoat. Beged means it is the word for treachery, because now what you see is not necessarily what you get. When the body was naked and it showed to the neshama, there was no possibility of treachery. And now, by the way, according to Kabbalah, beged, the alphabet in Hebrew starts with Aleph, that's the letter of the neshama. Right? Aleph is the letter of the neshama. And the next three letters, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, are beged. See, first the letter of the neshama, and then as creation progresses, you get the shell that surrounds it, that gives it a place to be. By the way, the other word for a clothing in Hebrew is levush. Levush spells lo bosh, not to be ashamed. The opposite of shame. So that was the solution. Right? It's interesting, you know, that the word or is a rule. Very interesting rule. Hebrew words that are spelt with an aleph, if you re-spell them with an ayin, you see them transition from spiritual to material. Now think about the makeless, fascinating thing. But if you take aleph vavresh, which means light, and you transpose it into ayin vavresh, right, which means that the garments of light became garments of skin, ayin vavresh, the Hebrew word ayin vavresh spells iver, which means blind. Before they were clothed in a medium that reveals, And now we covered in something that hides. By the way, this is called a hide in English. Somebody said, thick hide. Where did that come from? Originally it was a reveal, but now it's something that hides. Right? Or is it very blind? So here's the history. When Adam HaRishon was created originally, his body and his soul were in perfect harmony. You looked at the body, you saw the neshama. And after the sin, they crashed into a mortal conflict, right? Where the one seeks to destroy the other. And here's the key. The world's solution to that problem has always been to leave the body behind, beat it into submission, and float above it in spirituality. Right? If you look at all the great religions of the world, all the religions, the sects, the cults, especially in the East, but in the West as well, you'll see that the concept of being spiritual is to leave the body behind. If you're a Christian and you're serious about becoming spiritual, you have to become a monk or a nun. You cannot afford to engage the body. Because if you engage the body, it will bring you right down into the animal. And so they become celibates, ascetics. Muslims are not even allowed to own alcohol, you know that? Not allowed to own alcohol. Alcohol, drink wine, brings you right down into the material. Right? I had a friend when I was 18 who was a Mormon. Mormon? Utah? He wasn't allowed to drink, not allowed to drink Coca-Cola. No Coca-Cola, no tea, no coffee. Never mind alcohol. Who knows what you might do if you drink a Coca-Cola? You know, so stimulate. There's a deeply entrenched idea that to become spiritual, you must transcend and become ascetic and not touch the world. And I had the occasion to have a long-standing debate with a Jewish Buddhist. I wrote a book about that. We actually published a book together about our conversation. It's a very good book, by the way. You need to buy at least two copies if you want to understand it. But this new book that should be out in a few days, Yetzer Hashem, deals with free will, also deals with the battle between the spirit and the material. That tension is where our free will lives. But my Buddhist friend told me, my Jewish Buddhist friend, right, they call them Jew-Boos. Do you know that a quarter of American Buddhists are Jewish, you know? No. At least a quarter of American, and all the senior Buddhist leadership, the Zen Buddhist leadership in America is Jewish. Okay. So he tells me that they have an ascetic pathway, even those who get married. They're going to long celibate retreats where they don't engage in the marital area, they don't drink wine, right? There's a very pervasive idea that to be spiritual, you must rise above the material. And that is what Avraham Avinu brought to the world, the message that we have to reunify the two, right? And they said to him, you're crazy, you're trying to engage the material, it will bring you down. He said, no, we have to engage the material and lift it up. And they said, long before you spiritualize the material, it will crash your mind into a sensual mode. And he said, the deepest obsession of the Jewish mind is unification. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And therefore, we cannot tolerate the split world. Now, the Gemara puts it, says like this. The Shir Hashirim, the Medrash says like this. Very, very exquisitely beautiful. Shir Hashirim says, Acha Islanu Katana, we have a young sister. We have a young sister. So the Medrash says, who is our young sister? Achot, it's Avraham Avinu. She'iche es akera. He stitched together a torn world. He came across a world in which spiritual and material were separate things, and the word ach in Hebrew means to stitch together, right? Ichui. If you have a garment that's torn and you stitch it together, that's called la'ache. Right? Brother, sister are two people who are separate, but they have a common origin, right? The word in Hebrew for a brother or a sister is ach, it's the same as stitching together something that was once one and became torn, you restitch them together. Right? That's the concept. By the way, a very, very beautiful idea, too beautiful to miss. When Avram and Sarah crossed the border into Egypt, right? What does he say to her? Tell them you're my sister. Amazing thing. Now people think it's practical. Practical. If they think you're my wife, they'll kill you. The Torah's always dealing with much more than the practical. Here's a husband and wife, the prototypal, archetypal Jewish couple, the original model of Jewish marriage. They're leaving Israel and going to Egypt. Israel is the place of Kedusha, and Egypt is the place of marital contamination. Right? That's exactly what it is. The Torah calls it Erev HaSaaretz. And as they cross the border, from the place where marriage is holy to the place where marriage is contaminated, at that point he calls his wife his sister. And the reason is every husband should think of his wife as his sister. Why? Because husband and wife are two separate beings who share a common origin. Before they were brought down to the world, they were one being fused back to back, like Gemara Erevin says. They were fused at the back. There were two fronts, a male and a female front. They were torn apart and brought down to the world as separate people to mesh back into a oneness. So marriage is a brother-sister connection, just like brothers or brother and sister are two separate individuals with a common origin in the previous generation. Husband and wife are two separate people who were once one, fused together in the higher world, and are seeking now that reunification. So you see the same idea again. And if we had to summarize it, I would say that our task in the world, what Abraham brought to the world, was not a notion of God, but a concept that the spiritual and material worlds must express each other, must be meshed back together, right? To stitch together a torn world. The way we express that in Judaism, in Torah, is mitzvah. Mitzvah means that there's a spiritual idea in Torah and it expresses itself in the material. Right? That the word mitzvah means to bond together. It doesn't mean a commandment. In Hebrew, tzivui is a commandment. Mitzvah means tzavtachada, means one bond. In modern Hebrew, you have the word tzevet, means a crew, people to function together. Mitzvah means a physical action that brings a spiritual expression into the world. You do something with the body, virtually all the mitzvahs are physical actions, almost all, and they express something spiritual. They tie together, they stitch together two dimensions. Let's go back to our questions and try to answer them, and we'll finish with that. We asked a few questions. Did he bring the notion of Torah to the world? Shem and Eva were teaching it. But Shem and Eva were sitting on the mountaintop teaching that sort of Torah. What Avraham Avinu brought to the world was the fact that we have to bring it into the world. And that's why they tried to kill him. No one cared about people sitting on a mountaintop doing some sort of ashram, spiritual, you know, exploration. But tell us how to live, that we have to use the sensuality in the service of Hashem. That was a radical message. And for that, they tried to kill him. Why did Yaakov Avinu have to go and learn in Yeshiva and Shem and Avraham? Very interesting. You know that he was on his way to live in Lavan's house. You know who Lavan was? Lavan was the great master of separating the spiritual and the material. Right? He was a cheat. That means, do you know that the Zohar says, many places indicate that the neshama of Lavan later became the neshama of Bilam. Right? Bilam. And who was Bilam? The world's greatest prophet from one perspective. And the Midrash says he married his donkey. Right? He married his donkey. Meaning, you know that the word donkey, chamor in Hebrew, is the same as chomer, the material, right? And whenever you see a person riding a donkey, Avraham Avinu saddles his donkey and rides it. What does that mean? He's in control of the material and it's a vehicle for him. Right? That's what it means. The Mashiach will arrive riding on a donkey. Get him, get on the Concorde, you know, just bring him. It means in control of the material and that is his vehicle. Interesting, when Avraham Avinu comes to Al-Qaeda, he says, Shmulachem poi machal, he says to the two of them, you stay here with the donkey, with the material, I and my son transcend into a higher domain. But that is the meaning of, and Bilam cannot ride his donkey, because he's enmeshed in the chamor, the chomer, right? That is his thing. And Lavan is the same Nisham. And Lavan is the one who is tremendously spiritual. Bilam is a tremendous prophet. But in the material world, absolutely not. They have nothing to do with each other. It's like the great British philosopher of the last century who taught moral philosophy. Great ethics. And one morning his students found him crawling out of a house of very ill repute, disgusting place. They said, Professor, how could you teach us such great morals and behave in such a disgusting fashion? He said, what's the problem? Does a mathematician have to be a triangle? But that's not our world. Our world is a unification of the two. And when Yaakov Avinu was going to the house of a swindler and a cheat, somebody tremendously great spiritually, could not express it in the world, the Yeshiva Shem and Eva is the place you need to study. They are the people who understand what great transcendence means, separate from the material world. And that's why Rivka went to ask her question also from Shem. When Rivka felt this dichotomy, this split between material and spiritual and material, you don't ask Avraham Avinu that question. He's the man who understands the unification of the two. You ask Shem. Right? Those people understand transcendence and how far it can transcend the material world. And that's our battle and that's what makes us unique. The rest of the world has always taught that you leave the physical behind, you transcend it, you want to become great and spiritual, you levitate, you become ascetic, you come. And our message, unique message, is that we express our spirituality in the world. Torah regards it as sinful not to get married. A Nazir has to bring a korban because he didn't drink wine. By the way, you know, maybe we'll finish with this. You know that wine is exactly the symbol of Judaism. Do you know that we always take wine at the points of junction between material and physical, material and spiritual? We're so used to it, we don't even notice. Because one is a substance that if you have enough of it, makes you completely material. Completely. But you have the right amount, it elevates and opens the spiritual world. So whenever we want to show the junction between the two in the right way, we take wine. Here's a couple getting married, which involves an intimacy that the rest of the world sees as low and sordid. We have a cup of wine. We're going to convert this into sanctity. Bris milah, circumcision, the same idea, we take a cup of wine. Shabbos, when the week transcends into the elevated zone of Shabbos, we take a cup of wine where the two meet. Havdalah is exactly the same thing. That's called the Yerid Tzarech Aliyah. We are always taking wine at a time of expression, of putting material and spiritual. The Gaon of Vilna says that wine is the single substance that obeys the rules of the spiritual. It's material, but obeys the rules of the spiritual. The rules of the material are that material world always gets worse with time. All physical and material things get worse with time. Spiritual things get better with time, like wisdom and judgment. Wine is material, but it gets better with time, not worse. It's a material substance, but it obeys the rules of the spiritual. And so we take that substance, and the non-Jewish world is extremely conflicted about alcohol. Extremely. I saw a research article in a Boston hospital, inner city hospital in Boston. How many patients in that hospital were there for a reason related to alcohol? 50%. 50% of esophageal disease, liver disease, violence, accidents, brain disease, right? Amazing thing. How old do you have to be in this state to drink, to buy a drink? 21 years old. You need to be 21 years old to buy a beer. In Judaism, a kid's 8 days old, he put wine in his mouth. The non-Jewish world has had a fascinating relationship with alcohol. They're either tremendous problematic overindulgence or total abstinence. Right? There's a tremendous conflict there. And in Judaism, that is exactly what we do. We drink wine. We engage the material world. And therefore, in summary, I think that if someone challenged you to say what is unique about Judaism, it's not our God consciousness. It's not knowledge of Hashem. We know Hashem in an absolutely unique way. No one has a personal relationship with Hashem. That's why we stood in Matan Torah and no one else did. The Egyptians saw miracles, but they never had a personal meeting. But there's something more fundamental in a way. And that is that we use our bodies in a way that is spiritual. The rest of the world thinks that's ridiculous. The body is something that is sordid and fallen. It must be transcended. And what he brought to the world was the idea that we can elevate the body, right? We can do a mitzvah. We can take Torah and express it in the material world. We no longer can look at the body and see the neshama as once we could. Okay? We need clothes. And yet, we can express Kedusha, we can express a spiritual dimension in the world, in the body itself. And therefore, Torah expresses itself in mitzvah. It comes down into the world. Every aspect of that body is as an activity that can elevate it into the spiritual. And what's unique about us, really, is, and what he brought to the world, and we are still bringing down to the world, right? Speak to somebody who's interested in Buddhism, or whatever it is, a Jew who's taken by the East, and they find it very appealing, the idea of meditation and transcendence. And it's right, it's good, it's healthy. But it really is something else as well. And our deepest obsession is Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And that is the motivation to bring the material up to the level of the spiritual.
TorahAnytime.com sends cameras out day and night to video and audio record the best Torah classes around. We then make them available to you for free. So what are you waiting for? Watch, listen to, and download lectures on TorahAnytime.com today.